Hello and welcome to the Radio Times Doctor Who podcast, brought to you by the team behind RadioTimes.com. Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. My name's Hugh Fullerton.
My name's Morgan Jeffrey.
And this week, we are chatting all things The Vanquishers. Yes, we made it. We made it through all six episodes of Doctor Who Flux, which bizarrely, even though it was like the shortest series ever, it feels like it's been ages because there's been so much going on, so many twists and turns and theories and ideas. Turns out Bell and Vinders weren't the Doctor's parents, as far as we know.
The Doctor's real name is Digby. That's what we discovered.
Tigby, I think.
I heard Digby. I love that it's Digby because it's so un-sci-fi. Never mind.
Digby. anyway, yes. But we will be talking about episode 6, the series 13 finale, in a moment. Before that, though, we have our usual Who News segment. So, Morgan, what is the Who News we're talking about today?
Well, the biggest bit of Who News, of course, is that we got a Next Time trailer at the end of The Vanquishers for Doctor Who's New Year's Day special. Still don't know a huge amount about the episode, even after seeing the teaser, but we know it has this setting of elf storage. We get a glimpse of the guest stars played by Aisling Bea and Ajani Salmon. But the big reveal is that the Daleks are back. Who would have thunk it? The Daleks featuring in a Doctor Who New Year's Day special. Crazy, right? But you did make the observation, Hugh, that possibly this new January 1st episode is going to form part of a trilogy with the previous Chris Chibnall Dalek episodes, Resolution, Revolution of the Daleks. And we also see what appears to be the Doctor, Dan and Yaz getting exterminated by a Dalek. And it appears the Daleks have upgraded. They have some sort of new Dalek gun, some sort of machine gun upgrade. A few little teasers there as to what to expect on New Year's Day.
I'm quite intrigued by that. I mean, I kind of love whenever the Daleks get a little, very minor cosmetic change or like a new weapon or something. I am still mourning the loss of the sink plunger, which has been it's been very subtly, you know, Stalin style phased out. no one's made a big deal of it. They've just cleverly like twisted it. So like the Daleks don't have those plungers. They haven't had them since the Stephen Moffat era but then you don't notice because the first Dalek they had was like made from junk, and then they've got the revamped Daleks. They're clever. Different anyway. But then in the background, you're like, wait a minute, the bronze ones don't have plungers anymore either. But they're like, oh, maybe it's because their death's called Daleks. Look, this is a separate podcast. But so I'm quite intrigued by the whole machine gun thing. I think it's pretty cool. Although you had a theory that maybe that isn't really happening, right?
Well, just because maybe it is as straightforward as it appears, but obviously the Dr. Dan and Yaz are not going to get exterminated on New Year's Day, which what? Made me think. Well, I mean, maybe that's how John Bishop and Mandip Gill leave the series. Maybe that's how Jodie Whittaker regenerates. No, but so there's got to be some sort of an out. And I was thinking because of the message, the warning that the Doctor receives in The Vanquishers, which I'm sure we'll get onto a bit more later. The Doctor is fearing her imminent demise. Could this be some sort of nightmare sequence, some sort of dream where she? Yeah, I think she's heard to say in the trailer, not like this. Is she anticipating her own demise? Is she having a nightmare in which she and her companions are exterminated by the Daleks? And actually, it is all just a big misdirect. I mean, certainly their deaths would seem to be a misdirect. Is the appearance of the Dalek a total misdirect? Does the Dalek only appear in that one scene, in the scene of the Doctor's nightmare, and actually the Daleks don't play a huge role in the New Year's Day special? Remains to be seen.
I'm kind of intrigued by that idea. But I also feel like Chris Chibnall likes doing the Daleks on New Year's Day because, you know, that's in theory a kind of showpiece episode for the series where more people are watching. So they're kind of like, oh yeah, you like Daleks? Here's some Daleks. You know, everyone knows what the Daleks are. But yeah, we will hopefully have more info on that episode, the New Year's Day special, soon. It's nice that we don't have to wait too long, only a few weeks until we see that. But yeah, we'll have more info on that soon. But let's not get ahead of ourselves because we still have loads to talk about with the finale, aka The Vanquishers. And I was lucky enough to catch up with one of the episode stars, Craig Ells, who was obviously Carvanista. I would argue the maybe not romantic, but the tragic hero of this episode and Doctor Who Flux in general. So here's what happened when I caught up with him. But I have to confess, when the series was, you know, coming out, I was sort of like, oh yeah, you know, here's this funny dog character we'll see in episode one, maybe, and, you know, and then that'll be it. But then he's such a big part of the series. I mean, in the finale, I was just like, I just watched it and I was really moved. You know, yeah. If you told me in episode one that this sort of funny dog faced alien would like get you a bit choked up, I would have thought you were mad. But I mean, it's such a meaty role. I mean, was that something that appealed to you about it?
Oh, it was fantastic. As soon as I chatted with Chris and found out what the character was all about and who he was and what his purpose was, I just thought, what a fantastic idea. What a genius idea. And I don't know if it ever has been done before. I don't think it has. But the idea of the ultimate version of man's best friend is such a brilliant idea that, yeah, I couldn't wait to play him.
I mean, how did you get involved in the first place? Was it like a pretty traditional kind of audition process? Were you approached?
Yeah, just a traditional audition process. You know, you sort of audition for the role, keep your fingers crossed and wait for your agent to call back. Try not to sit and watch the phone too much because you know it's Doctor Who and you really want to do it.
And I mean, how was the character? You kind of touched on that a second ago there, but how was the character kind of first explained to you? Did Chris kind of say, look, here's the kind of arc we see for Carvanista and what we want him to do?
Yeah, initially he just sort of explained the bare bones of the character. And what we both had in common was Chris, as he explained in a sort of soundbite I saw recently, he'd recently not long got a dog. He's had a dog for about the same amount of time that I've had my new dog. And just like him, it's my first pet and it's his first pet. So I think we both at the same time have gone through that realization of how much you love your animals. As soon as one's in your life, that's it. You know, it becomes your world. And the idea of that relationship between man and dog. And he just decided he wanted to write a character who was a dog. And obviously that's significance with mankind. And so he just explained that. And the idea that, you know, we're going to think he's a bad guy at the start, as you see in episode one. But then as it transpires, he's actually there for a good purpose. And I just loved it. I loved it from the word go. So I was very excited when I got it.
And what was the discussion about, you know, the fact that he has the Northern accent? We've seen loads of aliens with Northern accents before, obviously. You know, Christopher Eccleston, obviously, as the Doctor. And yeah, Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor, you know, an alien with Northern accent. Was there discussion? Is it going to be that Northern accent? Is it going to be, you know, different ideas?
I think we both like the idea of the fact that he looks... Carvanista looks so cute and potentially very cuddly, but then if you give him a sort of gruff northern sort of voice, that he sounds very curmudgeonly and grumpy and sort of almost can't stand his mission, even though he's got to fulfill it because it's his genetic oath. So yeah, we just sort of arrived at that idea, really, that it would really counteract the cuteness of his appearance.
It definitely does. I mean, he's such an interesting character because, as I say, he's sort of a cute character. And then you see him as this quite like vicious warrior. And then you kind of feel sorry for him. And then you kind of, he's got this kind of sense of honor to him. There's a lot to it. I mean, I was wondering, there's a lot of emotions that he has to process, especially in the finale. And obviously you're covered in this fur that, you know, literally covers your whole features. I mean, did you struggle to kind of try and convey that emotion without being able to show any facial expressions, really?
Do you know what? It was... I mean, I suppose the first thing I've got to say is that the prosthetics team, led by Danny Marie Elias, were fantastic from the word go. They sort of talk you through it and hold your hand all the way through it, because I'd never acted in prosthetics before. So it was a completely new sort of venture for me. And it is slightly overwhelming when it first starts to go on and you realise that your entire face, and then with the costume and the gloves, your entire body is covered. It is slightly overwhelming, but such is the genius of the prosthetics that it went on in parts. So there was sort of a chin piece and then a bit that went over the nose and the forehead. So actually, when I moved my face, you can get slight movement in there to show the emotion. And then the rest obviously was down to Chris's writing it and whatever was going on in the scene. But no, I loved it. And I think you mentioned it before, that last episode. When I first got the script, I remember sort of messaging Chris to say, I was genuinely moved. The moment where he howls.
Yeah.
Genuinely moving to find out that the whole of that Lupari race that was only ever sent to down to Earth to save mankind is now gone. It was quite, it sort of gave me goosebumps.
Yeah. I mean, it was quite a moment, I think. I mean, it's sort of almost, you know, he suffers the most of anybody, I think, by the end in the series. Like, he's the one who's left, you know, the last of his kind. You know, it's quite, you know, quite a dark ending for Carvanista, really.
Yeah, it is. And obviously, the last time you see him, he's on that ship with the Ood and Bell and Vinda. You sort of think, well, what's he going to do now? I always imagine he's quite the lone wolf anyway, no pun intended. But he's, I do sort of imagine that the Lupari race are, you know, they're out there, they sort of work as a pack. In my head, they're quite individual creatures. So I imagine he's quite grumpy generally. He probably spends a lot of time by himself anyway. But yeah, the fact that his whole race has gone and he knows that there's no one else out there like him is, yeah, genuinely really sad.
I mean, there is a little sort of hint of levity, as you say, at the end where he's with Belle and Vinda. You know, it's a family and their dog, as you say. I mean, it's suggested, he denies it, that he might stick around with them a bit longer. Do you think he might? Do you reckon he could keep traveling with those guys?
Yeah, I think like you see with his relationship with John Bishop's character, Dan, there's a sort of love-hate relationship. He's grumpy, but he knows he's grumpy, but he kind of loves him at the same time. And although he's trying to give it all, oh, I don't want these on my ship, I want them to go, I think if they stuck around a little while longer, he wouldn't be too disappointed.
I mean, it's pure spin-off material, right? You know, you've got you never say never.
I'm living for it. I'm waiting for the phone call. I'm waiting for it. It's a Dog's Life starring Carmen Easter and then Belle and Vinda. Bring it on.
I mean, I'd love to see it. I mean, you know, but generally speaking, in the show, I mean, when we asked Jacob a few weeks ago, we asked, you know, after this series, depending on what happens, would you like Vinda to come back? In Doctor Who, no one's ever gone forever. Gemma Redgrave hadn't been in it for, you know, 7 years or 6 years or something, and she came back. If asked, would you like to bring Carmen Easter back to the series? I mean, it kind of seemed like he and the Doctor had a bit of unfinished business in a way because they had that history.
Absolutely. Oh no, I think like most people, I would jump at the chance to come back and be part of the show again. It's a friend of mine said when I first got the job, he said, "Wow, that's amazing. It's like getting to play for your country, isn't it?" And it is. You know, you step up to being Doctor Who, it's like being handed an England shirt, or you know, and so right now's your time. And you do feel a sort of honour and a responsibility all at the same time. But yeah, what a privilege and what a joy to play someone like Carmen Easter. And yeah, I would absolutely come back and play him again.
And thank you for that, Craig. I really enjoyed talking to Craig, who really lovely guy. And yeah, I kind of hope we see more of Carmen Easter, Belle and Vinda, you know, like the spin-offs. I mean, look, the Jericho spin-off is a bust. That's not happening. So.
Yeah. That campaign has come to a very abrupt end, even though they couldn't write out Jericho without giving him a few more absolutely cracking lines where he describes himself as the scourge of scoundrels, which is going to be the subtitle, I think, of the inevitable Big Finish box set. But yeah, no, that campaign came to a very sudden end. So yeah, no, I'm totally now throwing my weight behind backing the Belle, Vinda and Carmen Easter spin-off, getting up to larks around the universe.
I mean, I can't wait. It's going to be great. But yeah, no, I'm quite like intrigued by this episode. We had a couple of weeks where we largely agreed on this, and now we've slightly diverged again. So overall thoughts on the finale for me, I liked it more than last week. I thought actually it tied things up pretty well. It did manage to resolve all the plot lines. It was a lot of stuff happening. It was a lot of stuff thrown at the wall, a lot of storylines. They had to have three doctors in order to keep it all together. Like last series for The Timeless Children, they had two masters because there was so much going on. This time they had to have three doctors. It's literally like the three doctors this episode. That was maybe another title for it. But it kind of worked for me in a way last week didn't. I think because in a similar way to how I quite liked the Halloween Apocalypse and you didn't, I think I don't mind it so much if it's at least kind of pelting along a bit, if that makes sense. You know, like it did feel like there was stuff happening. It didn't feel like stuff was just being explained to the Doctor over and over again, which was maybe the issue with The Timeless Children in 2020. I kind of felt like it tied things up relatively nicely. You know, there weren't any really big surprises, I don't think. I don't think there were any sort of huge moments. It was kind of just like they found a way to fix the flux. All the monsters got killed, of which we might talk a bit more about later. And, you know, everyone was kind of reunited. Everyone just got popped off and everyone was like, great, we've sorted that whole thing. Let's not talk about the fact that presumably the moon's been destroyed twice and Jupiter and all that. Let's just not discuss that. You know, all these planets were ravaged. We're just going to, no, that didn't, let's just not talk about it. Literally an entire species were wiped out. Let's make some dog jokes. You know, just move on. We're going to go to, you know, New Year's Day and fight some Daleks. But yeah, so my thing was like, I was sort of pleasantly surprised because I wasn't sure after last week whether it was going to pull things together. And actually, I feel like it worked. I don't think it's the best finale Doctor Who's ever had. I don't think it's like, it's definitely not my favorite episode of the series, but I feel like when people look at it as a whole, I feel like the Flux kind of experiment worked. I think it did what Chris Chibnall wanted it to do. And yeah, I am quite, you know, I think it worked. I mean, what were your thoughts?
Well, you wrote a piece, didn't you, last week saying, will Doctor Who Flux stick the landing? Because of the serialized nature of this story, so much of how it will be perceived in the future depends on the reaction to this final episode. Because if as you know, as you said, the Series 12 finale was more divisive, and a lot of people's opinion of Series 12 was kind of colored by their reaction to the whether or not you like Series 12 now is sort of dictated by whether or not you liked The Timeless Children, which actually Series 12 was generally quite well received, you know, quite broadly well received prior to that. And for me, The Vanquishers was not my favourite episode of Doctor Who Flux. That being said, I think you're right. I think it ties things up in a mostly satisfactory manner. Like there's not a huge amount that's left dangling other than the sort of broader series threads of you know, will the Doctor get her memories back and certain character relationships. For me, though, like, I think I've been pretty consistent in my reactions to these six episodes in that I preferred the ones that were more, despite actually I think the serialized story being that structure and that experiment being, I consider that to have been a success. I enjoyed the episodes more that were more standalone. I enjoyed my two favorites were probably Village of the Angels, far and away the best, and then War of the Sontarans. And this to me, I think even more so than Halloween Apocalypse, it just felt like a lot of stuff going on. And you're right in that it absolutely rockets along. It's definitely not dull. Like it has, like, you know, incredible pace to it. But there's, I think I said this about Halloween Apocalypse too, but for me, it's even more so in The Vanquishers because it has to tie everything up. There's a lot going on, a lot of different locations, a lot of different characters. And it just means that not everything gets its due. Like, Jericho had a great final scene, but actually isn't in the episode all that much. Grand Serpent is a nice performance from Craig Parkinson, but doesn't really get a whole lot to do. Kate Stewart makes her grand comeback, doesn't really have that all that much screen time.
She just stands in a tunnel, like the whole episode.
Yeah, right, yeah. Like, what happened to Unit? Is Unit back now, I guess, maybe? Because the Grand Serpent's gone, but it has been dissolved. So, yeah, it just felt quite frenzied to me.
Frenzied is a good word for it, I think.
Yeah, so and that's not necessarily a bad thing if it's just, you know, full of energy and vigor. But to me, I think at points it veered over, it sort of crossed the line to being a bit garbled and a bit, there was, you know, too much all at once, which was also a criticism I leveled at Halloween Apocalypse. So certainly not dull, certainly not a failure, but also certainly one of my one of the episodes I enjoyed less, just because it was so rapid fire and so frenzied. But it did pay off everything I think it needed to pay off.
Yeah,
so I kind of had mixed feelings about this episode.
Yeah, I kind of went in with slightly lower expectations, I think. And I think actually the fact that the storyline was kind of all tied off, I was like, okay, grand. You know, the way they used Passenger to, like, you know, swallow the whole Flux, I'm like, okay, that's clearly why you invented that, you know, technology in the first place. Okay, that makes sense. You know, the Ravagers got, like, you know, blown up and they were very happy about it. Fine, they're gone, whatever. The Sontarans love chocolate now, and now they're all dead.
I mean, yeah, I quite liked actually the Passenger fix, because it's neat in that it makes sense, but I didn't see it coming. Like, it's I think some people maybe will have an issue with that and say, oh, that's a bit, you know, oh, that's it and the Flux was solved. But actually that it feels weird to call Passenger a character, but, you know, that idea was there, that Passenger is this kind of endless void. We knew that had been established. So it's neat. It works. So I actually thought that was one of the more successful parts of the episode. Like I say, the way in which it resolved everything, and it resolved the Joseph Williamson subplot, which earlier on in the series, I was like, I have no idea what this is about or where this is going. And I don't think there'll be a satisfactory answer to it. And there was, it all kind of played out. So the way in which it resolved the Flux storyline, I was a fan of. I just think there were a lot of, as I said, a lot of ingredients thrown in there. Not all of them got their due, which is, I think, pretty much exactly what I said about Halloween Apocalypse. And I just wonder if there's a version of this episode that could have worked just as well with fewer characters. Like, I love Kate Stewart, and I love J. Gemma Redgrave, and I think it was great to see her and that character back. But if you remove that character from this episode, if you remove the Grand Serpent from this episode, what would you lose other than the fact that they're in the episode? Like, I feel like it could have been streamlined and it could have felt a little less, as I said, frenzied.
You could probably cut, you could cut Jericho from everything past Village of the Angels. You mm-hmm. could have cut Belle from this episode. You know, you could probably cut, you could maybe not carve an Easter, but you could probably cut quite a few of the characters and definitely Kate Stewart, and it wouldn't have changed the story. Like, I mean, Jericho managed to sneak in as a psychic, even though he's not psychic. And it was a nice sort of moment for the character. But, you know, his role in the last episode and this episode was kind of to keep Yaz and Dan company, essentially. Mm. And then he gets killed. And it's like, it's sad, but I was a bit like, I don't really, you know, he doesn't need to be here. Like, it kind of, that felt like very much, I mean, that has been very much the case in the Chris Chibnall era, right, where they do just have a lot of characters. Like, remember, Orphan 55 was just stuffed with all these characters. You could have had, like, three less. And I think that is a thing that we've seen in this era, both with companions and with, you know, side characters. They'd always do pile quite a few in. And, you know, in some cases that works really well. Like, you know, I know you and I have had our differences about, you know, like, Carvin Easter and stuff, but... You know, who can deny he's the star of the next Doctor Who spin-off now? Like,
do you know what? And actually, I don't know if I've warmed to him or if I'm just used to him. But actually, I think it was more actually when Carvin Easter was presented as an antagonist in Halloween Apocalypse, that didn't work for me because the character is inherently silly. So, and you know, later on we learn more about the character and the character. It becomes this, certainly not comic relief, but becomes a more sort of, you know, likable, amiable, supporting character, a little bit gruff. The character the character fulfills that function fine. It was more in Halloween Apocalypse where the character was initially presented almost as like the big bad of that episode. And yeah. I was like, well, this doesn't fly because that character is inherently quite ludicrous. So I will say I've warmed to Carvin Easter now. Maybe not as big a fan as you have been throughout, but I've definitely warmed to the character.
He's my breakout of the series, Carvin Easter. Also, to be fair, like the most emotional bit of the episode for me was, you know, him being sad about his, you know, race being wiped out. And I've got to say, you know, for a guy wearing about, you know, 6 pounds of fake fur, Craig Ells did a good job of emoting behind, not just with the howl, but with the eyes and stuff. Like, he actually made that quite sad. And also, to be honest, arguably, the scene with Carvin Easter from The Doctor, where he kind of just says that thing of, like, I would have done anything for you, but, you know, now I've put a universe between us or whatever, and you left me. I was a bit like, God, there's a bit of, like, meat there. There's a bit of, like, character work there. And I'm a bit disappointed that they kind of brushed over it. And he has this thing in his head that blows up if he talks about things. And it's like, oh, let's not try and take that out. Bye. You know, I kind of feel like there's some stuff unexplored there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, absolutely, despite my mixed feelings about Carvin Easter as a character, I think you're absolutely right. Credit to our podcast guest, our Craig Ells, who, particularly in this episode, you're right, he absolutely sells the emotion despite being dressed as a giant dog, which is yes. like not easy. But, you know, the actor's tools, the eyes are still there. And there's a lot going on in those eyes. Yeah, no, absolutely fantastic. And I think that, you know, it does, as you touched on, I think that does feel like there's potential to find out more there. Maybe not a spin-off, although, you know, I'd tune in. But yeah, there's definitely more to be discovered about Carvin Easter, I think, in his past with the Doctor.
Yeah. So, okay, that's the Carvin Easter bit of the podcast. There's so many things to get through. I'm trying to think what I should talk about. I mean, we should talk a bit about the Doctor, right? Obviously, the Doctor is three different characters this episode, essentially, because she's split up for weird time reasons. This is one of those ones where, like, you know, I'm kind of like, sure, you know, maybe that does that, because it's a made-up technology that doesn't exist. Maybe it would do that. That's one of those logic things that doesn't really bother me. I guess it's interesting that we've seen this before, obviously. In Journey's End, we had two Doctors, partially because in a similar way, there were a lot of different, you know, cogs whirring. They needed maybe two different Doctors just to fill the whole story. In The Timeless Children, there were two Masters. The Doctor's quite passive in that episode. The Master's almost the lead character in that, and he kind of has a similar thing where he's off with the Cybermen, and he's also facing off with the Doctor. In this one, they you know, amp it up, three Doctors. And I was a bit confused because I thought it was like, oh, she's sort of you know, going between these different places and times, like in her head, like that's why she's fading in and out. But it was like, no, there's three of them. And it's sort of like, you know, the ganger, Matt Smith doctor, and, you know, like it's, yeah, they actually can interact. It was quite confusing.
I sort of read it as there are three different doctors, but sharing one brain initially, at least. So they're kind of, that's why the doctor's mind is flitting between, you know, it's sort of, in a way that we can't perceive, or that can't be really portrayed accurately on in a television show, is sort of experiencing all three of those lives simultaneously. But you know, to us, it's seen as flitting from one to the other, because I don't think any time has passed, you know, between doctors. When you cut back to say 21st century Liverpool, Yaz and Dan aren't saying, you've just been stood there for half an hour and not saying anything.
Yes, that was my question. I was like, does she sort of go, like, you know, like a little spinning wheel on her forehead for a minute.
But then in other scenes, she is kind of phasing in and out. So, and then she actually turns up and can clearly interact with herself. So it's not entirely clear, but it's one of those things where it's not present. You're right. It's not presenting itself as logical, right? It's kind of veering on the Doctor Who. It almost feels wrong to call it science fiction. Sometimes it's more of science fantasy, because it's more kind of, it's almost magic at the end of the day. But yeah, it doesn't, with some scientific babble thrown in, it doesn't really matter how it works. The one thing I just thought is that Jodie Whittaker must have been absolutely exhausted, because playing the Doctor is like a big, you know, it's an energetic role. You're in a lot of scenes anyway, but she's pretty much in like every scene of this hour long episode, and sometimes twice, and like doing a lot throughout. And I know one of the doctors is just kind of lying down and wincing, the one who's being held captive by Storm and Azure. But even so, like, kind of, you know, credit to Jodie Whittaker on what is like a big performance three times over.
Yeah, and technically four times over when you get to time. Jodie Whittaker plays four different characters in the same episode. It's her Orphan Black moment, although they are obviously all basically the same. So it's a little bit different. Yeah, no, I thought that was quite interesting. You know, quick note on Thasmin Watch. I did feel like that moment between the Doctor and Yaz in the TARDIS, I mean, there was a little frisson there, I thought. And then they get interrupted and Yaz looks sort of annoyed.
It's, again, as I said with last week, where Yaz is watching the hologram and it's played like she misses her partner, her girlfriend, right? It's it's played with the same kind of feel and beats as if they were in some kind of romantic relationship, or at the very least, as if Yaz is pining for the Doctor. And as people have pointed out, it's a clear parallel between Vinder and Belle, who are romantically involved, who are life partners, and they have the hologram of each other. So, like, it's clear, there's a clear parallel. And that scene in the TARDIS between Yaz and the Doctor is played like one of those scenes where two people are about to kiss and then someone else interrupts them, and it interrupts the tension. It's played exactly like that. So, you know, where Dan blunders in and interrupts the scene. So I can't, again, like with last week, I can't think it's accidental.
It's interesting though, because it doesn't seem two-sided. It seems quite one-sided. Like, it does seem like Yaz that feels that way and the Doctor doesn't, to me. Like, it does. The Doctor seems to be acting kind of the way she would always act.
Yeah, I think if I really hope it is played out in some way, because I think they've kind of laid the groundwork for it, and it would be a shame not to explore it. But I don't think you're going to get necessarily the Doctor and Yaz declaring their love for each other. I think more likely is that kind of maybe a bit of a Martha Jones situation, where it is more one-sided, or, you know, the Doctor, I think, you know, the closest you've come to this sort of mutual love is the Doctor and Rose. But even then, it's a thing of like, I can't quite do this in the way that you do it. I don't quite have the same feelings and thoughts as you do, because I've lived for a billion years. So this is, and you can't stay with me forever. So this is different for me. I think you can have that kind of conversation in it. I think that's probably where it's heading.
I think so. And like, so much of, as well, the Jodie Whittaker era has been, you know, a bit of a riff on the David Tennant era, I think. Like, sometimes explicitly, sometimes more subtly. And I feel like I could see them, you know, exploring something similarly to that. Yeah, so that's, you know, Thasmin Watch, a new segment of the podcast.
We'll knock up a jingle for that.
Yeah. But I was going to say we could talk about Dan. There's not that much to talk about with Dan. He kind of is just there for most of this episode. He does have that little bit with Diane where I think she pretty unfairly blames him for being abducted by Azia. Like, oh, if what? Only you'd met me on time, this alien would have abducted us both or something. Or like, I don't really get it.
No, it took me a little while where I was like, well, is she just actually mad at him for being late? Like, there's other stuff going on here, Diane. And then I was like, oh, I guess because he's late, that's why she got kidnapped by Azure and Passenger. And she sort of blames him for everything.
I don't think that logic tracks, though, because would you? like, he was also abducted. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's very strange. I don't know. I mean, I get why. I think maybe, you know, generously, you could say she kind of had a really horrible experience. And now that the sort of adrenaline's down, because she seemed pretty chirpy in Passenger. Now that the adrenaline's gone down, she's sort of like, God, I had a horrible time. You know, you kind of embody that for me because you're the reason it happened. So maybe, and she's not like saying, oh, let's never hang out again. She's like saying, maybe let's give it a little break. But equally, you know, what really happened to Diane is like she met a scary lady and stood in some water, and then she hung out like in the countryside, space countryside, for a couple of weeks and then got out. Like, what? It wasn't the worst thing. I mean, yeah, again, Carvanista lost his whole race. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And like Dan was stranded in the past for 3 years. Come on, yeah. Diane. Like,
come on, Diane.
Cut the guy some slack. Now, I do think, though, again, talking about Diane, it's a character who, I like the character, I like the performance, I like the actor, but what if you look at Diane's sort of arc throughout Flux, which again I think is a she's a victim of it having too many characters and too much going on. Mm. What was Diane's arc in this series, especially where she kind of like, I don't think it's entirely clear, she's left in Passenger. Vinder says, why were you left alone? And she says, well, because I'm insignificant. But it's not really clear why she wasn't.
I assumed
wasn't...
it's because she's a useful hostage because of Dan. That is basically what I thought. I don't know why you'd get her and not like Yaz's family, but you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You take it as read, but
why was she not used to build the, you know, to build this bridge to
I
division?
I guess maybe they thought she was still useful because of Dan, you know, being out there like that. I think there is, you know, I saw it as that initially was like, oh no, it's because they think I'm insignificant. I was a bit like, as opposed to like the random other people they grabbed.
I like the idea that Swarm and Azure are just really worried about Dan. They're like, that we need like a hostage.
They've been watching the videos. They've been watching the Evil Dan videos, and they know, you know, nobody needs soup more than him. And
he's coming. Yeah, he's coming for us with his wok. We need something on him to stop him from coming for us. Yeah,
that's exactly what it was. I think that's text now. It's not just, you know, jokes or subtext. You know, Dan is the most feared being in the universe. But yeah, no, I know what you mean. That was, again, like you say, that's kind of, I feel like Diane was mainly there to give Dan some sort of motivation to stick around, and then for Vinder to have someone to talk to in that episode. Incidentally, it's quite interesting the way that they sort of pitched Vinder at the beginning of the series as like he's almost a companion, because it did seem like it was going that way, especially in episode 3. But then actually I don't think he's in it more than like anyone else really by the end. He's kind of just part of the cast of thousands that you have in this series, right? Like he's the same as Bell. It's just that he turns up earlier, really.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Like, yeah, it was almost like, is he now part of a four with the Doctor and Yaz and Dan? But actually, there's we'll maybe get onto this later, but there's a lot of characters who almost qualify for companion status throughout Flux. You know, Vinder is a sort of quasi-companion, but so arguably is Bell, so is Carvanista, so is
Jericho.
So is Claire, another character who, again, really liked the character, really liked the performance. But did Claire need to be in this episode? Central, absolutely central and pivotal to episode 4, but didn't feel like she had a huge amount to do here. I didn't really understand how...
Yeah, what was the point of that? Like, now I'm thinking about it. Like, it's like, oh yeah, you guys need to pose as psychics to get inside the Sontaran thing. And you're basically going to be tortured horribly. And then actually you're going to help the Sontarans in their plan. And then just leave.
I didn't entirely understand how the Sontarans were using humans to find out when the final Flux event was. Maybe it's explained, but if it was explained, I missed
it. They said it was a psychic thing. They said they were looking for psychics because,
right,
you know, psychics can do stuff like that. They can see the future. And basically, you know, we know Claire is psychic because we've clairvoyant Claire. So we've seen, you know, that in other episodes. So I guess it makes sense from that perspective. I don't know. They're not screening very well, though. I also love the idea that you could bribe a random Sontaran with chocolate, which you can just get anywhere in like supermarkets and stuff. And then he'll like be like, yeah, this seems legit. This is fine.
He was literally surrounded by chocolate, but they were like, and there's plenty of chocolate like on Earth, but they were like, we can teach you like the Cadbury secret recipe. And he was like, well, I guess I'll betray my race. I don't know. Yeah.
It's sort of, I mean, I guess they sort of presented it as like, oh yeah, they really want to be in the psychic thing. And he's like, this sounds legitimate. You know? Yeah, I mean, so sometimes generally in this episode, not to go away from Claire, but sometimes generally in this episode, I felt like they were slightly less well-used than they were earlier in the series. I think they were pretty good in War of the Sontarans. In this, it was kind of like, I will say, the Sontarans, for maybe the first time in a while, really good plan. Like,
great plan.
Really smart. Like, actually, I mean, maybe the Grand Serpent was behind a bit of it, but I was like, fair play, that's actually pretty clever. And, like, it kind of worked until they got, you know...
What I like is that this episode is called The Vanquishers, and when that title was announced, everyone's like, who are the Vanquishers? Is it Swarm and Azura? Is it something else? The Sontarans are the Vanquishers. After all, like people are like, oh, they're comical villains. The Sontarans are the big bad of Flux. They like, yeah, they school the Daleks and the Cybermen. Like, yeah, absolutely.
Absolute, like, gullible idiots. What is the meaning of this? We totally want to hang out with you guys, says the Daleks and the Cybermen. I mean, like, what? How could you betray us? I found that quite funny. I mean, I sort of believed it because, you know, the Flux thing's happened and, you know, people are desperate. But then equally, it's a little confusing. I will say as well, that section, I think, is going to be quite... I mean, maybe, you know, we'll see what people are saying on Twitter, but I feel like it's a bit controversial as an idea because the Doctor kind of commits genocide. And I know we can't throw around that word to Lucy, but Doctor Who has used the word genocide before. But yeah, basically... The Doctor kind of by inaction and then also actively by what she does with the, you know, what she and Carver needs to do with the Lupari fleet, kills, you know, all of the Sontarans. Mm. The Daleks and Cybermen are also killed. And they're like, great, quid's in, basically. And it's sort of like, it feels odd because obviously, you know, it's been presented before as like bad that the Doctor would try and kill a load of Daleks in Journey's End, which we mentioned earlier. Like, that's the thing the bad Doctor does, and he has to be sent away to like have a nice life to teach him a lesson. And similarly, even in this series, the Doctor tells off a Crimean War general or colonel, whatever he was, for blowing up the Sontarans when they're retreating. I know it's a little different because the Sontarans are kind of brought it on themselves and all this, but it did sort of sit a little uneasily with me as the way that the Doctor's been portrayed, in that she does sort of allow and sort of make the mass extinction of like these various species happen. And they are like comically evil, all of them. And, you know, in another show, maybe it wouldn't really matter. But in the way Doctor Who's done it, she's supposed to be sort of slightly above that sort of thing, I think. Mm. So I feel like that was kind of an odd moment in the show. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the Daleks and the Cybermen falling victim to the Flux, you could argue that that is the Sontarans' fault. You could even argue that the Sontarans sort of get their comeuppance and just sort of fall prey to, you know, their own plan sort of does for them. But then again, you're right in that that only happens to the Sontarans because of what the Doctor and Carvanista do. Carvanista is basically the Ninth Doctor at this point. He's, you know, he's vengeful and out for blood. So I kind of get why he did it, but it doesn't make a huge amount of sense why the Doctor does it. No,
it's
but, also, I mean,
I think it's not that she does it. I think it's that there's no like qualms, there's no discussion, there's no like, well, oh, I did this and this is bad. Like, it's just not acknowledged. It's just like, oh, that happened. Like, the Daleks getting killed is almost like bonus. You know?
And there's literally, and they literally say, are we going to save the Daleks and the Cybermen?
And we're gonna warn them. And the Doctor goes, no, my idea is more risky.
Yeah,
it'll kill them all.
Yeah, nope, definitely. Like, I'm making a clear choice to kill them all, which is interesting. Doctor Who, though, has always had the two things that are most flexible about Doctor Who are how time travel works and exactly how the Doctor feels about killing. Because the Doctor's always, you know, the Doctor's a hero, so always has to be very opposed to killing until it's time to kill the bad guys, which is always the kind of the moral quandary at the heart of Doctor Who, which doesn't always make a huge amount of sense. The show, neither the show or the character has a kind of concrete position on. Like we talked about last week with UNIT, the Doctor sort of opposes UNIT blowing up the monsters until it's useful for UNIT to blow up the monsters. So yeah, it's questionable, but I think also kind of in line with what we have seen in Doctor Who before.
Yeah, I think it will be a thing people talk about, but for a little while at least. But yeah, it was something that stuck out to me. I think because of the thing earlier in the series with the Sontarans. But you know, maybe the Doctor's like, oh no, if they're retreating, no matter what they've done, it's totally wrong to kill them. Like, oh, if they're just like hanging out looking for asylum, then let's blow them all up. Like, essentially. That's fine. We should talk a little bit about, you know, because we've talked a lot about lots of different things. Talk a little bit about the ending. You know, we've talked about the flux is resolved. Everyone's sent home. Everything's fine. The Grand Serpent is sent to live on a rock, like the, you know, that there's like that book about the little, little French boy who lives on the moon or whatever it is. He's just hanging out there on his own. The Grand Serpent essentially is a bit pointless in this episode, but whatever. He has some nice arguments with Jodie Whittaker. And then Swarm and Azure kind of very happily get killed by their boss, who is Time, who in the style of the first evil in Buffy the Vampire Slayer takes the form of, you know, whichever actors they have around. And so the Doctor faces off with the Doctor in the sort of the black coat that we saw earlier in the series. And it's quite an interesting moment. I don't have the exact quote here, but you might still. Do you still have the exact quote?
Yeah, so Time, the personification of Time, also played by Jodie Whittaker, tells the Doctor, "You can leave here, but you can't outrun me. Your time is heading to its end. Nothing is forever. No regeneration, no life. Beware of the forces that mass against you and their master." Ah, so there you go.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, and this time, the Doctor, learning her lesson after Spyfall, goes, "Wait a minute, there might be a double meaning to that word. I'm not just going to take that as red." Yeah, so she's kind of like, "Wait a minute, what do you mean by the master," essentially? And then she just gets sort of, you know, blooped back into her, you know, normal body and time zone. And so it's not answered. But yeah, it's really interesting, this moment, because it's the first time, I think, on screen that there's been an acknowledgement that Jodie Whittaker is going to regenerate. Obviously, we've known in the real world for a while, but it hasn't been part of the arc of the series until now. I was wondering, and I've written about this a bit on RadioTimes.com, whether they're going to kind of, in David Tennant's style, have that as Jodie Whittaker's final arc being, ooh, what's going to cause the Doctor to regenerate? And the Doctor, who kind of loves life, doesn't want to regenerate because it is like a kind of death. And is, you know, last time it was the Master. Well, not last time, but I think actually, yeah, it was last time. Most of the modern Doctors, three out of five will have been to do with the Master, it seems. So yeah, I am quite intrigued by that. We kind of have heard rumors for a while that Sacha Dhawan is coming back. Obviously, he's been spotted around Cardiff. And I think people saw a box that said like Master Props or something, which people were like, maybe that's just the main prop box, but it could also be a full of like, you know, little doll figures and tissue compression eliminators and things like that, and nice waistcoats. So yeah, it seems pretty likely. It also seems incredibly likely that they'd bring him back before Jodie Whittaker goes. Considering they had such fun, you know, opposite each other in the last series. So yeah, that's quite interesting as well. So yeah, it's a nice sort of tease for what's coming. I'm glad that like the Flux storyline was its own thing and that's kind of been there, but they're sort of setting up what feels quite, I'd say it felt quite natural to kind of set up the specials as like we're running towards the end of this incarnation. Like, I don't know if necessarily the New Year's Day special will be much about that. I can imagine it wouldn't be. I can imagine they'll kind of just do their own story. But then maybe the spring special, and then obviously the centenary, which is Jodie Whittaker's last episode, you know, presumably will sort of tie together. But yeah, you know, I was pleased they included that, and I was glad to have a little nod to the Master. Although I genuinely thought Time was going to take the form of the Master.
100%. No, I did too. Well, because it's purple. Right.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, this is gonna, it's gonna take the form of Sacha Dhawan's Master. 100%. No. But yeah. So when it was Swarm, I was a little bit confused at first. No, but I think you're right in that the New Year's Day special will probably be like a bit of a day off from the arc storytelling, and then the whole arc for the Doctor in Flux was about, you know, and has been ever since Time's Children, was about rediscovering those memories and wanting to learn all about her past and her past lives, and she finally gets the opportunity. She has the Fobwatch in her hands now and actively makes the choice not to. I guess it's interesting what, you know, and kind of deposits it within the TARDIS. So it's kind of, it's there. Should anyone ever want to revisit it, either Chris Chibnall or another writer. I don't know if, you know, is the Doctor scared of what she may have done in the past and so chooses to, but it does feel like maybe at least for now that arc has been put to bed. And so, this now sets up the next arc for, like you say, probably the kind of the second special and the centenary special where she regenerates. It's all going to be building now to the end of the 13th Doctor.
I will say, we didn't see the Master in this episode, although there was a hint. I was slightly surprised we didn't see Jo Martin's Doctor. I thought that they would bring her back for more than one episode this series. It was just a very kind of quick, not quick, but it was a fairly sort of limited cameo in the middle episode. And they, which is, you know, where Jo Martin thrives, it seems, in these series. She turns up in the middle and is great and then isn't in it very much again. But I would assume she will come back at some point. But it's interesting that they didn't include it. I guess, look, we were just saying there's so many characters. It would have maybe been a bit much. It would have been a cool thing for Time to take her form, but it wouldn't really make sense necessarily for, like, what we'd seen before. Although now I said that, I'm like, oh man, they should have done that.
They should have done that. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Oh man. Because that's, but then I guess they kind of did that exact thing in Timeless Children where she was the Matrix interface or whatever it was.
Any excuse to get more Jo Martin in there, right? I think anyone would agree.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think that I'm quite interested in where the series goes next. It feels like the Flux, I'm glad that that all was quite like resolved and all the characters kind of went home, as it were. And now you do kind of have, like, you know, the Doctor, Dan and Yaz are together. They're going to head off. You know, the Doctor's maybe got this thing with the memories. The kind of active players like Tecteon and the Ravagers are gone. But, you know, the memories are now there in play. She could get them back. She might not. I'm not quite sure what in this episode made her change her mind, but whatever. And, you know, then we've also got this looming regeneration, which has been, like, stated on screen. It kind of feels like it's a good place for the show to be in as we kind of head into this end game for Jodie Whittaker's Doctor. And I'm quite interested to see what happens. Like, I think, weirdly, the one I'm most interested in is the spring special, because the New Year's Day special, I kind of have an idea in my head of what the kind of thing it's going to be is. And obviously, the centenary, we know a fair bit. Not loads. We know a bit about it. And we kind of have an idea. It's the last episode. The spring special intrigues me because we don't know anything about the story. And I don't really get how it's... I can't work out what its role is in the whole thing. Maybe it's like Planet of the Dead, you know? Like,
yeah.
It was sort of had a bit of moodiness, but was mostly just larks on a flying bus.
quite possibly, because it's too far apart from the centenary special in October to form any kind of sort of real two-part story, right? You know, I think it would be a big ask to end the spring special on a cliffhanger that then only gets resolved like several months later and expect everyone to remember exactly what happened. So I imagine it'll be, there'll be more or less standalone specials, but with this new arc of, the Doctor's impending doom, plus possibly... will the Doctor get her memories back, kind of threaded through, but subtly, at least until we get to the centenary?
Yeah, and then we'll find out, you know, if they give the Doctor her memories back or not, because they might not. Like that, like you said before, that kind of might ruin the mystery that they've reintroduced a bit. But also, it's kind of like, but then if you just ignore it completely, then what was the point? So you've got to find some sort of
middle ground
there, I guess. Yeah, and I'll be interested to see what they do with that. But yeah, I think that's pretty much everything from The Vanquishers. We will be talking more about Series 13 as a whole in a future episode of this podcast. This was very much just our review of The Vanquishers. But yeah, I'd say overall, I think it did the job. I think it was a finale, you know? The finales of Doctor Who are often not, you know, the most sort of... what's the word I'm for? The most elegant of episodes in general. And I think actually, considering how much there was to resolve, I think they did a good job. And I kind of see episode 5 in context a bit better now. And I'm like, I see why they did it the way they did. Do you know what I mean? You know, like last week I was saying, if they can kind of make an exciting finale, I'll forgive them for episode 5. And I think that's basically, I feel like pretty okay with it. And looking at the series as a whole, I'm like, cool. I do feel like it's a shame in a way that you don't have any of those sort of, the closest you have is, as you say, the Weeping Angels episode, any of those sort of like brilliant standalone episodes that Doctor Who's so known for, where you can look at it, watch it in isolation and be like, wow, how great was that? Because it's all got this Flux stuff going on, you know, every episode. So, you know, in a way, the serialization maybe will make it less of a rewatch. But, we shall see. Anyway, I'm getting into my Series 13 commentary now. We've got to save it for another week. Before we go, though, we do have, as ever, our controversial question of the week. Roll jingle.
Controversial question of the week.
I forgot to say roll jingle last week, and it caused no end of bother, so sorry about that. This week it's slightly themed, because one of the interesting developments in The Vanquishers was that Carvin Easter was the Doctor's companion. Interestingly, also, that the Doctor said companion, which isn't a thing that she has said that often, as a sort of concept. But we kind of were talking about this afterwards, and there's always a question in Doctor Who is what makes a Doctor Who companion? You know, what Doctor Who companions aren't really companions? Because obviously there are some who you can just say, look, they're like second on the call sheet. They're in the opening credits. They're there the whole time. You know, your Karen Gillans, your Billy Pipers, your Mandip Gills, they're proper companions. They are the Doctor's sort of base. They go in. But then you sort of think a bit more and you're like, what about characters like River Song? You know, she's never like a full-time companion, but she travels with him. What about someone like Vinda, who is sort of in this whole series and does technically travel in the TARDIS, but isn't like quite a companion, but was almost billed as a companion before the series started? What about the Brigadier from the classic series, who was a recurring character for so long with so many Doctors, but was never like, you know, the Doctor's number two person coming with him? And then, you know, does he deserve the position less than someone, you know, who was in it for like a couple of episodes, who, you know, isn't even in it that long? Like, we've had a few examples over the years of companions who've only been in for a couple of episodes and they kind of moved on. I mean, Morgan, what's your take on it? You suggested this question. I've talked a lot, but...
Well, they bring it up in this episode, and, you know, the Doctor actually... I like that the Doctor actually actively asks Carvanista, were you my companion? Almost like, so fans won't argue about it. So it's like, so now it's like, well, you know, it was literally addressed on screen. The question was posed on screen. I think it's... and then I suggested we should talk about this. What makes a companion a companion? And then what also would disqualify you? And like in my brain, I've always vaguely thought of it as it's a character who travels in the TARDIS with the Doctor, but for more than one story. So, and that's the kind of the baseline of what a companion is. But then, as you say, there's, for various reasons, there's all kinds of variables to that. So the Brigadier did travel in the TARDIS, but wasn't like a traveling companion in the same way. You know, he didn't sort of from story to story travel the universe with the Doctor. So, but then are we saying that the Brigadier is not a companion, but Adam Mitchell is? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think we're probably going to end up with one of these sort of non-answers, which is like, it's this, except when all these variables are taken into account. Because I would definitely consider recurring characters like, I don't know, actually, because now I'm thinking about it. I would consider the Brigadier a companion. I would consider, like, a big variable is the John Pertwee era, which is set on sort of then present day Earth. So there wasn't a lot of TARDIS traveling going on initially, at least. So that opportunity wasn't really there. So, but you still feel like characters like the Brigadier and Sergeant Benton and Mike Yates, who are in every story, still qualify as companions. But then I don't know, I don't feel like River Song is a companion, even though Alex Kingston is in a lot of stories. I don't feel like she qualifies, but she's kind of the closest modern equivalent to the Brigadier, so I'm not even entirely sure why that is.
Well, I've had an interesting thought, which is because I was thinking maybe we can use companion more as a thing for us rather than for the show, in terms of like in the world of the show, the Doctor's just got some mates who she takes traveling with her, you know, like it's not all that often that they say, oh yeah, this is my companion, you know. I like, there's a joke, you know, with Clara where she says, I'm his carer. And he goes, yeah, she cares for me because I can't be bothered.
But
I was thinking about the David Tennant era of specials, because explicitly, in every way we would say, or every single way we would consider a companion, Michelle Ryan, Lindsay Duncan, David Morrissey, and Bernard Cribbins are the companions of those episodes, but they're only in one story. They don't travel in time, apart from, I think, Adelaide Brooke does, Lindsay Duncan's character, briefly. And I think Wilf maybe does, I can't quite remember. But basically, you know, but they are definitely the companions in those individual episodes, aren't they? Like, you know, Lady Christina is the Doctor's companion in that episode. So then do they count? Because that completely goes against the rules we just said.
I don't know what it is. It's so much like about like personal feeling and who you feel has like earned the mantle, I think. And that will probably change from person to person, because I feel like Lady Christina, not a companion. Adelaide, I think it is, Lindsay Duncan's character. Again, great supporting character, not a companion. Who was the other one you said?
David Morrissey.
David Morrissey, Jackson Lake, great character, great supporting, great guest character, not a companion. Wilf, 100% a companion. And I don't know why.
I think it's because he's in it for a while before that.
Maybe.
And he kind of played a role. So it's, I think maybe he edges over because he was the sort of behind the scenes, you know, he was the official companion and then also was in several episodes.
Yeah.
Whereas the, you know, most people are one or the other. Like there are, you know, people who are the official companions, but weren't in as long as he was, or there are people who were like in it for a long time, but weren't the official companion. I think maybe he kind of just, you know, gets over the line. And then, you know, if you look at something like the episode, like Twice Upon a Time, who's the companion in that episode? Like, is there one? You know, there's, is the Doctor, is the companion.
The 12th Doctor is the First Doctor's companion in that story.
And vice versa.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then,
yeah.
But then also Bill is in that episode, so you could say she is, but she doesn't really have that same role. And then you have, you know, Mark Gatiss is almost in that as the captain or whatever he was, is almost the, you know, the same. So it's a really interesting question. I think it says a lot about, like, Doctor Who, though. Like, it's the sort of thing fans think about a lot. And it is one of those things where, like, it's like art, you know. It's like, I don't know what it is, but I know what I like. It's like the sort of thing people say. And it's kind of a bit like that. It's like, I know it when I see it.
Yeah, like, yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly it.
You're kind of, because I agree with you with those characters. I mean, you know, I would say that you can have a one episode companion. I mean, look at Donna Noble, who is a one episode companion, then becomes a proper full series companion. Was she a companion in that episode? I mean, probably not. Was Kylie Minogue a companion? In that, you know, like,
well, do you know what?
It's so difficult.
I think something else that's important is not so much how the character is designed, but how they interact with the Doctor within the story. I think a crucial part of whether or not you're a companion is if you have that little moment of, you know, do you want to come with me? Do you want to come in the TARDIS? Yeah. You kind of need that moment, which Dan kind of has a couple of times. He has it in earlier in Flux, and then he has it again when he kind of returned to present day Liverpool in the Vanquishers. The Doctor's like invites him on board, you know, to travel. I feel like that kind of makes you a companion as well. And but then it's like, well, technically, I can't remember, was Astrid, was Kylie Minogue's character invited
Astrid
on TARDIS?
Astrid
was asked. And so was Linda, Joe Joyner's character from Parting of the Ways. It was kind of, she was kind of invited aboard. So it's like, was she a companion for about 10 minutes before she was horribly murdered? Like, even that.
Maybe she like had a job offer, but didn't, like, you know, sign the contract,
yeah,
as it were.
Exactly. Yeah. But I do feel like that offer is important as well. Like, if it's almost like, does the Doctor consider you a companion is a key part of it.
I think that's a good point. Yeah. I think maybe whatever the Doctor thinks counts. Mm. And maybe the Doctor wouldn't think about this in these terms. Like, that's why I always find it odd when the series includes companion, apart from as like a sort of gag where they go like, ah, the faithful companion, you know, like, and it's sort of like a nod for fans. You know, it's sort of almost like that isn't necessarily saying, oh yes, the Doctor's companion. Mm. So I found it interesting when Jodie Whittaker in this episode was like, oh yeah, were you my companion? I was like, I don't think you use that terminology very much. Like, that's more of a fan thing.
Yeah, it's one of those fan pieces of terminology that has gradually been adopted by the series. But if you think about it too much, like, who says that? Like, no one calls them. You would just call them, I mean, maybe not the fam, but you would just call them like your friends or your mates or whatever. But companion is a very sort of like austere, quite old-fashioned term, which sort of made sense in the 1960s when they were writing up production.
Well, they were called
documents.
The assistants then, weren't they?
No, yeah, well, exactly. No, that's a good point. Yeah, no, assistants, which is probably... Yeah, so I think you're right. Like, I don't think there is a kind of, which is the answer we come to a lot with these controversial questions of the week.
Who knows?
Who knows? I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. I think it depends on how people want to perceive it, except in the case of Carvin Easter, who it is explicitly stated on screen is a companion. So that is now, update your TARDIS wikis. That is now official fact.
Well, there you go. And, you know, we look forward to the Big Finish spin-off. You know, Craig Ells says he's up for it. So
Carvin Easter Chronicles.
The Carvin Easter Chronicles. I mean, it's going to happen.
With a K.
That'd be great. Oh, I definitely listen to that. But anyway, look, if you have a different opinion, please let us know. We always enjoy your feedback. Well, most of the time. So get in touch any way you want to. Usually probably the best is via Twitter at Radio Times and stuff like that. That's all we've got time for this week. Another bumper episode from us. But we will be back to talk about Series 13 as a whole. And hopefully we will also be chatting soon about the New Year's special and things like that. Until then, I've been Hugh.
I've been Morgan.
And we're each other's companions. It's very sweet. Thanks for being a part of that. And thanks for listening as well. And goodbye.
Thanks for listening to our Doctor Who podcast. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to never miss an episode. And for more brilliant Doctor Who content, check out radiotimes.com.